Okay, I think we're going to make a start. A very warm welcome to this seminar. Our visiting speaker today is Rajesh Venugopal, who is Assistant Professor at the Department of International Development at the LSE. Before that, he taught at the University of York and also was at the University of Oxford. He's a member of the Editorial Board of Nations and Nationalism, and his general kind of research interests fall in the area of the political sociology of development and violent conflict with respect to South Asia. And it's great to have him because he has just published, in the last few weeks, right?
Yeah.
In September, this book, Nationalism, Development and Ethnic Conflict in Sri Lanka. And that's what it looks like up there as well. It came out in September. And he's literally just flown in this morning from Sri Lanka, where he has been launching it in Sri Lanka and Colombo. You come straight from Sri Lanka to the Central South Asian Studies here to talk about it, and that's fantastic. Welcome. We look forward to the paper.
Thank you. Thank you, Sujit, for a very kind introduction. Thank you to Ed. Thank you to Barbara, who have been instrumental in sort of getting me to come here. As Sujit has mentioned, I'm going to talk about my new book here today, Nationalism, Development and Ethnic Conflict in Sri Lanka, which has come out literally two, 3 weeks ago. I was actually in Colombo just 48 hours ago, literally doing this same book talk in a very different environment and a very different talk to a different audience. So I'm going to spend the time I have now, about 40 minutes maybe, sort of going over some of the big themes in the book, and then also talking of the book and to the book and the process of writing it and what were my preoccupations to some extent. Now, as you'll note from the title, the book covers a number of different issues and it speaks to a number of different kinds of audiences. So it's nationalism and ethnic conflict on the one side, development on the other side, and Sri Lanka also. So it speaks to sort of peace and conflict studies, it speaks to critical development studies, which I really come from, and also to South Asia studies. And I've tried to sort of calibrate speaking about this book to the different audiences, and I'm sort of assuming that you're all South Asianists, and I will sort of speak to that that little universe. But in doing so, let me also... if you'll allow me to start with a certain note of discomfort, as it were, which scholars of Sri Lanka often face within South Asia studies, because as some of you may well be aware, the study of India dominates South Asia studies to the point where scholars of Sri Lanka or Nepal or Pakistan often sort of feel that we are a bit ignored within this field. There's a great example, actually. There's a very important review article on nation building and nationalism in South Asia, 1947 to 1990, by a leading scholar who shall go unnamed. But that big review article does not have any mention at all of the one country in the region which has faced the longest running civil war on the basis of nationalism. It's all about India and Pakistan to some extent. So to some extent, people who study Sri Lanka face the fact that even within South Asia studies, we're a sort of a small piece. And there is also the tendency to sort of have the study of Sri Lanka looked at through the lens of the much larger literature on India and its more vivid and tragic polarities. I think to some extent this is inevitable. This is sort of part of the indignity of being a small country. And what I feel at stake and what I've tried to do in this book is to promote and pursue the study of contemporary Sri Lanka in itself and for itself, and not in terms of the so often ill-fitting categories that are drawn from elsewhere. And also not as a one-country case study that bears mention only insofar as Sri Lanka provides empirical fodder to feed a comparative debate that is itself irrelevant in understanding Sri Lanka. Now, the book is out, and as happens often when you write a book and it comes out, the book is about the past, but once published, the book also sort of passes into history itself, as it were, and it starts becoming stale the minute it's out. So the book is about the past, but it's also about the present. And I think it's important to mention the present context, the post-war moment that Sri Lanka is in, 9 years after the end of the civil war, in which the war is over, and it's often talked about that the war is over, but the conflict is not, as it were. And the conflict remains resistant to resolution due to many of the structural factors that gave rise to it and rendered it irresolute for the decades that preceded the war. So that Sri Lanka continues to be the site where that past tends to be reproduced and relived in the future. And I'm going to turn you to something very different, something far from Sri Lanka, which is something that I think it reminds me of when I see it. This is, for those of you who might recognize it, this is the penultimate scene of Gillo Pontecorvo's classic film, The Battle of Algiers. And just before you see this in that movie, there's a classic moment of dialogue and a scene that's penned that captures some of the elements and the atmosphere of the post-war moment in Sri Lanka. Now, in that scene, the French counterinsurgency chief, Colonel Mathieu, and a group of his fellow officers are walking casually down the steps of the Kasbah, the old city, the Arab quarter of the city of Algiers. They have just trapped and bombed to death the remaining insurgents of the FLN. Along, by the way, with those FLN members, it must be added, a young child who both sides found to be expendable for the greater good. But having done that and having killed the insurgents, the fight is over. And the officers, you know, Colonel Mathieu and his fellow colonels are at ease. They are walking down the steps of the Kasbah. You see smoke in the background. And they're lighting up cigarettes and they're relaxed. And they're chatting. You know, Mon Général arrives and they're explaining to the general, you know, what's going on. And the conversation is really interesting because it sort of bears the smug satisfaction and the condescending magnanimity of the victor in his hour of triumph. And, you know, one of them says, you know, at heart, they're good people, the Algerians, you know, we'll be friends again at some point. And I say that because in many ways the circumstances of that conversation and that smug satisfaction, the air of fake magnanimity, also frame the point of departure for ethnic relations in post-war Sri Lanka, where a 26-year-old civil war ended in 2009 with the crushing victory of the Sri Lankan military against the separatist insurgency of the LTTE. Can I just check, by the way, the people in the back are able to hear me? Okay. And in this enduring post-war moment, the agenda item that faces Sri Lanka as a country, as a society, as a polity, as a in terms of government policy even, is this twofold work of reconstructing and reconciling. So reconstruction and reconciliation, economic development and ethnic reconciliation, if you will, remain those two large, dominant, pressing items on the agenda today and perhaps in the foreseeable future. And what I'm doing in this book is to look at the relationship between these two larger, dominant agenda items that are on the agenda today in terms of how they have evolved into being in the present, how they have evolved in the late colonial and the post-colonial period, that is for much of the course of the 20th century. So this book is at one level about that grander problem in the social sciences more generally perhaps, of relating the economic to the ethnic, of relating the material world to the cultural, the subjective side, if you will. And in the course of looking at it, the book ends up saying a lot about the fundamental concerns and the polarities that constitute the study of the political sociology of Sri Lanka. Let me just have a quick word on disciplinary evolution. I've been working on this book for a long time. I work in an interdisciplinary environment of development studies. I worked on it on and off for, almost 15 years. It was originally a large part of the book as part of my doctoral thesis. I haven't only worked on this for the last 15 years. I've done other things as well. But it's important because I think it reflects, the book in some ways, and over the course of writing it, you know, I have evolved intellectually over the years, so it has been challenging to sort of keep up and to, and I don't agree with many of the earlier formulations that I had, so a lot of what I've been doing with this sort of perpetual treadmill that I faced in trying to finish it was trying to actually say something that I myself agreed with in the present and not just what I felt like in the past. So for the book, for example, it started out being about development and economic development at a time in which I, as you were, self-identified as an economist at that time. And as I have evolved, I think that the book and the kinds of questions that I asked has also evolved so that they try to engage with a more broader intellectual corpus today. I try to speak more to politics, sociology, and the anthropology literature as well. Now, trying to do that and work at that intersection means that one is also working at two very different traditions and ways of understanding how economic development and economics in the material world perhaps relates to ethno-nationalism and conflict. And on the one hand, in economics and in the very positivist frames of the development industry, there's a very positivist, technocratic way in which one looks for a cause effect connection. You try to analyze it to see if poverty caused the conflict, unemployment caused it, caste caused it, governance caused it, a failure of public service provision or legitimacy can cause conflict. Or conversely, you try to see if having understood that relationship, you can then deploy that understanding to mitigate and to reverse conflict in policy, so to speak. So in this way of understanding it, the ethnic conflict in Sri Lanka, the nationalist ideologies that dominate it, and politics in general are often seen as epiphenomenal. That is, that there is a sort of base and superstructure understanding in which that economic core is really what drives everything, the economic roots of conflict, so to speak. But secondly, and very differently, there is another way of understanding, a different type of knowledge, a different type of knowing this connection between conflict and development, in which it is the economics which is superficial and epiphenomenal, and it is the underlying and often hidden politics of it, which is the essence, which we have to try to explore, excavate, and identify, expose. And this tradition doesn't take the stated intentions of the development industry or the purported causal relations at face value, but it's much more suspicious, and I sort of call it suspicionism. It goes beyond the technical evaluation of development projects or of government policy to look behind it and to try to see what might be lurking behind it. What is that hidden agenda behind it? A lot of the anthropology of development literature in terms of my sphere, development studies, is much more interested in looking at it in that way. Now, what I think is very interesting is both of these very divergent ways of understanding economic development and ethnic conflict tend towards what one might call mutual reductionism. That is, the positivist side sees conflict as fundamentally economic, and that economic development can then mitigate the politics of nationalist conflict, which it sees as reducible to economic grievances. So that nationalism and conflict are superficial manifestations of what is an underlying economic challenge that needs to be understood. And the other approach argues that it's a converse, that economic development and its technicalities are the illusion behind which lies the real essence, the substance, which is this deeper political agenda of domination. Now, I think both of these are very rich, and I've tried to sort of engage with both of these from a certain vantage point that can include them. But I think in and of themselves, I think it's important to bear in mind that the study of the politics of development should neither be naive to the effects of power and perhaps also not mesmerized by it to the extent that it takes over. This book is effectively a study of a series of studies on singular nationalism, ranging from its agrarian origins, the elite mass divide and how it's articulated in electoral politics, to the nature of public sector employment, something that I call the transition from kulaks to clerks, the open economy and authoritarianism of the J.R. Jayawardena period, the effects of military employment, corporate sector peace activism, the very internationalized peace process of 2002 to 2005, the phenomenon that is the Janata Vimukti Paramana, the JVP, and amongst other things, the executive presidency, the institution of Sri Lanka's executive presidency, which came into being with the 1978 constitution, and which is all the way down to the Mahinda Rajapaksa period, which ended in January 2015. So let me just spend a couple of minutes going over what I think are the big questions that I'm trying to look at. Or at least if I don't address them, what I think are the big questions that are out there that one would want to examine within a book like this. And so the first big question is there an economic core that underlies the ethnic conflict and nationalism in Sri Lanka today? So among economists, for example, there is widespread sort of this understanding that premature welfareism in Sri Lanka in the 50s and 60s and a lack of employment in the 60s and 70s was very important in understanding how the conflict catalyzed. That Sri Lanka did, as the economist Joan Robinson famously said, ate the fruit before it planted the seed. And elsewhere, in a different tradition, but also somewhat perhaps within that trajectory, that tradition of looking for the economic sources of conflict, is the idea that the ethnic conflict is in some sense a particular the result of a particular form of capitalist development that caused the conflict. That it is in some way perhaps the distorted effect of a certain form of class formation and capitalism. So that's one. And I'll come back to this later. The second big question is, well, if there are economic causes to conflict, does that mean that there are economic solutions that can be put forward? And interestingly enough, post-war Sri Lanka under the Rajapaksa period, between 2009 to 2014, did this very famously. They consciously pursued economic development over ethnic reconciliation. And it was suggested very widely that the bricks and mortar of roads, bridges, airports, ports would address the underlying drivers of the conflict. And that, you know, providing these ornaments of infrastructure would help to reintegrate the northeast of the country that had been affected by the war, that it would rebuild legitimacy amongst the conflict-affected Tamil population through service provision, interestingly, there's a great quote that I put up here. Mahinda Rajapaksa explicitly states this in 2011. This is when he was opening the Southern Expressway. And he says, well, separatist tendencies will fade away when we have better road connectivity. In other words, development in that period and under that government contained not just an economic purpose of rebuilding, but it was viewed as a project of ersatz conflict resolution. That is, in lieu of and instead of and in the aspiration of transcending the difficult tasks of forging ethnic reconciliation, addressing issues of justice, sort of negotiating constitutional futures, one could use economic development and bypass that. Now, having said that, I think it's also important to bear in mind that the idea that development can be deployed as the vehicle to understand and reverse violent conflict is not an innovation of the Rajapaksa period in Sri Lanka, and it's not even unique to Sri Lanka in that sense. More generally, violent conflict has, since the early 1990s, been incorporated as a very central feature of development theory and practice within what is called liberal peace building, within the large internationalized missions of state building and intervention that have taken place around the world. But I'll just give you another very interesting quote that came about just a few weeks ago in the newspaper. And this is Narendra Modi in India at the inauguration of a series of development projects in the Maoist-affected central parts of India. And he makes a very similar claim that, Naxalism, the menace of Naxalism, as he puts it, can be eradicated only through development. And he says, I believe all sorts of violence has only one answer, development. So that was the second big question. The third big question, which sort of falls out of it, but it's important enough in its own right to list it separately, which is, how does one relate ethnicity to class in understanding the political sociology of contemporary Sri Lanka? And I'm going to throw out a couple of things over here that will guide you towards what I'm thinking and where I'm coming from. And the first is Ernest Gellner's very famous sort of jibe at Marx and Marxists more generally, that the message of liberation that was intended for class in the 20th century by some terrible postal error was delivered to the nation and to ethnicity instead. That those that were sitting around waiting for liberation and emancipation and revolution to come through the medium of and through the message of class found to their horror that this was a period in which class actually ebbed and it was ethno-nationalist conflict that was the dominant paradigm by the end of the 20th century. And certainly people in Sri Lanka of the left that had expected that have also gone through this journey of seeing that the message of class was ultimately undone by the dominant role of ethnicity and ethno-nationalist ethnic polarization in Sri Lanka. A second way in which I look at it is the idea of how to understand the political spectrum and the party system in contemporary Sri Lanka. How does one understand how the economic left and right relates to the ethnic left and right? How is ethnic politics transposed to class politics, as it were? And just to give you a very brief glimpse of it, the answer that I have and that I talk about in the book is this idea of what I call cosmopolitan capitalism versus sectarian socialism. And I've talked about the cross-polarization of the left-right axis in Sri Lanka, which is very different and quite unique in Sri Lanka, which sets apart, for example, the central role that the Sri Lanka Freedom Party has played in Sri Lanka since its inception, and which makes Sri Lanka very different and its political configuration very different to, for example, the role that the Pakistan People's Party plays in Pakistan, the Indian National Congress, or the Awami League play in India and Bangladesh, respectively. The big question number four, how do we understand the role of elites in modern Sri Lanka? And I say this particularly in respect to a very famous quote that James Maynard has made in 1978. And he talked about the fact then, writing about Sri Lanka, that the elite mass discontinuity, rather than the Sinhalese-Tamil discontinuity, is the principal cleavage in the polity of Sri Lanka. So I wanted to address in this book that issue of the elite mass relationship, really picking up where James Maynard sort of enigmatically left it off 4 decades ago. And I'm also engaging here with some of the very interesting work that's been done in Sri Lanka with respect to the role of elites and ideology, particularly the way in which James Brow and people that have written in his tradition, such as Wust, have written about the role of Gramsci and hegemony in trying to understand the relationship between social hierarchy and ideology in contemporary Sri Lanka and with respect to singular nationalism. I also engage here with the idea, which is very influential in Sri Lanka, of elite instrumentalism. And this is the idea that singular and Tamil nationalisms can be understood in terms of projects that the elites within those respective communities have advanced and to some extent constructed in order to create and preserve their own political positions and their elite status. I have very serious concerns, by the way, both about the application of Gramsci to understanding singular nationalism and about elite instrumentalism that I talk about in the book. And next, the issue of the executive presidency in Sri Lanka, which came about in the 1978 constitution, the sort of the way in which Jayaprakasa sort of brought to Sri Lanka the semi-presidential system, the premier presidential system from the French Fifth Republic, and the way he brought it in a way that, this is my interpretation, as a way for elites to recalibrate the elite mass equation and to reverse the populist tide that came into Sri Lanka from the 1956 elections onwards. I'm going to talk very briefly about inspiration and framework. There's a lot to say here. I'm just going to sort of, once again, perhaps cryptically or enigmatically sort of touch upon a few things. Firstly, it's not really that important, but I think it's something that I was reading at the time in which I started working on this book more than a decade ago, which is the book Modernity and the Holocaust by the Polish sociologist Zygmunt Bauman. And there were two very interesting things that he said there, which were really captured my imagination, and I think I sort of influenced the way in which I looked upon my work, which is he said that, and he's writing about the Holocaust, you know, that great genocidal crime of the 20th century, and trying to say that, well, people that have written about the Holocaust have written about it as, for the most part, a picture. So you imagine a picture on the wall, and we study the Holocaust as if it's a picture. And we look deeper into that picture. We look at the weft and the weave of the canvas. We look at the color. We look at the faces. And we interpret it, and we look for deeper meaning within that. And Bauman says, well, that's a mistake. You know, instead of looking at the Holocaust as a picture, why don't we look at it as a window that can tell us something else, as a window that allows us to look beyond it, and which is what, I mean, he's telling us a lot about the condition of modernity through this. And the second thing he says, which is really interesting, he says, well, you know, in a great deal of the literature on the Holocaust, the discussion of guilt masquerades as the analysis of causes. And I was very taken by Bauman's sort of the way in which he sort of painted how one looks at knowledge and how one goes about understanding it and finding it out and relating to it. So that's just one thing. The second thing I'm going to talk about is the fact that, you know, the work is very interdisciplinary in the sense that I've talked about my own evolution. I come from a background that was from economics to some extent, and I've tried to continue to see how I can stretch this, engage with people that are working on related subject matter in history, and economics and politics and anthropology. The approach that I've viewed myself coming to this book with, which is perhaps what others might not read into it, but it's certainly something perhaps I should come out with and out myself, is the idea that I have what I view as an extended political economy approach. And within that, there are really three components. So firstly, in looking at contemporary development and nationalism in Sri Lanka, I try to situate my work in terms of broader socioeconomic trajectories and to try to make it very historically informed. And secondly, I view it, I think it's very important that it is sensitive to the role of class and to economic factors in explaining contemporary political outcomes. And thirdly, I place a great deal of emphasis on the nature of the state, on the structure of political competition, and how power is constituted, and how it is sustained by political, economic, social elites. As someone in Colombo a few days ago said, well, doesn't this is just historical materialism in sort of a vulgar way. And to some extent, yes, I do plead guilty to being influenced by that tradition. And I think in the Sri Lankan tradition, it's not just an intellectual tradition that provides you with academic parameters as such, but it's also very critical in providing a certain set of humanistic foundations to the work that I've anchored it in. But having said that, I think it's also evident for those of you that will stray into the book that the material that I look at struggles to work within this approach. It really strays from its conceptual parameters and ultimately perhaps exposes some of its inadequacies. And that is that's going to be evident in one level from the presence of concepts and dynamics that are typically outside of this milieu. For example, the little nod I have to what some people would call the ontological approach in anthropology, the inner world of nationalist subjectivity, and the way in which I think it describes, that is, nationalism forms, it can be viewed as a form of morality that regulates and governs conduct in the political sphere. And at another level, it's evident in the way that the evidence and the analysis that I present in this book challenge many of the traditional political economy received wisdoms, the causal links that exist in the Sri Lankan literature. Perhaps the most important of these are in the relationship of economic liberalization to the ethnic conflict in the 1980s, in the Jaya Jayawardhanam period, in the idea of elite instrumentalism, or even in the adequacy of the Gramscian concept of hegemony. So I will say that these are the positions that I've advanced elsewhere, completely unrelated to this, for example, on neoliberalism. I don't view these as hostile assaults against the edifice of political economy analysis or the people that are deeply invested in it. I really view it as critical points of engagement from a sympathetic insider, perhaps, rather than a hostile assault from the outside. A quick mention on methods. A lot of the work that I've done in this book, a couple of the chapters in particular, are very much based on archival work. It's really a lot of economic history, reconstructing historical economic data, looking at the censuses, the administration reports, the agricultural censuses from the early part of the 20th century, a lot of work on the newspapers and the archives from the 1950s to the 1980s. That's one part of it, which is more historical. Another part of it is looking at contemporary forms of evidence that is economic, household survey data from large household surveys. And a third part of it, which is a lot of interviews that I did in Sri Lanka in the sort of 2006 to 2012 period from a very diverse group of people, from the man who's currently the Prime Minister, which is my most frustrating interview ever in my life, to the man who wrote Sri Lanka's PRSP, the Poverty Reduction Strategy paper in 2003, for that man, for Ranil Wickremesinghe. And a whole bunch of people, including nationalist ideologues such as the author and dental surgeon Gunadas Amarasekara, the late and great trade unionist Bala Tampo, who passed away in 2015, which I really found to be the most interesting. Business elites, trade unions, Communist Party leaders, all of which really infuse the second half of the book. So let me spend the last 5 to 10 minutes that I have just going over some of the larger chunks of the book and larger projects that I have done. Do I have enough time?
Yes, sure. Plenty of time.
Okay. So in the first substantial part of the book, I have tried to describe what I talk about as the political operation of singular nationalism in contemporary Sri Lanka. And I do it through five pillars. So firstly, I argue that nationalist politics takes place as an explicit political project of majoritarian domination, or the so-called singleization project. That's the most evident and obvious form of the political insinuation of nationalism. But there are four other ways. The second is, beyond that outer political world, there's an inner world of singular nationalism evident as a cognitive moral framework. In other words, I talk about the fact that it provides the basis on which many people are able to recognize what is legitimate from illegitimate in the dangerous realm of electoral politics, and it provides them with a set of moral beacons. Thirdly, this moral framework is the basis on which singular nationalism forms the argot, the jargon, the patois, if you will, of instrumental political discourse between people and state. In other words, it's the language of a certain kind of political communication and performance. And fourthly, it constitutes a certain form of class consciousness against Sri Lanka's westernized post-colonial elites. And in that sense, it needs to be situated within the history of a particular kind of elite mass dynamic. And fifthly, it structures the political party system in what I've described as an inverted left-right axis along the ethnic versus economic axis. That's one part. The second part is what I have provocatively, and I will accept a little bit inaccurately, described as kulaks to clerks, which is based on a large amount of sort of reconstruction of socioeconomic data from the early 20th century onwards. And what I try to do there is to draw on a modified version of the socioeconomic framework that Ernest Gellner talks about to examine the impact of agricultural change, welfare policies, and government employment in the making of a mass singular nationalist consciousness in the 1950s. And a large part of it is an agrarian economic history of Sri Lanka, and it draws extensively upon data on land, on education, on exam results, on population growth, civil service employment, and so on. And it really talks about the intergenerational class transition from what one would call the middle peasant to the middle bureaucrat. Not really kulaks to clerks, as it were, but that has sounded cooler. And this transition becomes particularly acute during the 1950s, and it plays an important role in catalyzing the growth of singular nationalism from what one might call its intellectual phase to a mass political phase. And the third big component of the book is to examine what the idea, it's the title of one of an article, Market Reform at a Time of Civil War and Ethnic Conflict. And it's the relationship between market reform policies and the prosecution of the civil war in the period 1977 to 2000. And what I'm trying to do is to dwell on the complex and unanticipated ways in which the prosecution of the market reform agenda, and particularly the political acceptability of those reforms, became intertwined with the exacerbation of the ethnic conflict and the prosecution of the civil war. So I've talked a lot about J.R. Jayawardene, who I think is still the most fascinating personality in 20th century Sri Lankan politics. A man who was born an Anglican and ended up being characterized as an authoritarian singular Buddhist chauvinist. And I've talked about J.R. Jayawardene and the United National Party, the UNP, in promoting a new counter-populist politics and a strategy of state reform, and how J.R. transformed his party, the UNP, in the 1960s and the 1970s. And I've tried to talk about the way in which he tried to create this more authoritarian institutional structure, how he promoted Buddhist religiosity, and expanded state development programs manifold in the strategic politics of trying to subvert and neutralize the powerful populist electoralism of singular nationalism. It's a very different argument to the way in which J.R. is typically talked about. It's a little bit controversial, and I've talked about the way in which the unforeseen and uncontrollable consequences of his policies ended up triggering the ethnic conflict and being impossible for J.R. to put back into the bottle the genie that he had pulled out of it. And next, it's a very different kind of way of looking at the relationship between market reform and ethnic conflict. I try to look at the way in which the civil war since the 1990s, perversely, while it was extremely expensive in terms of its economic cost, also became a source of economic and political stability through the mechanism of military fiscalism. And I've used a lot of quantitative data here to say that military employment had by the mid-1990s become the most important source of poverty alleviation and upward mobility for the rural Sinhalese hinterland. And it's very contrary to the traditional view that wars, of course, have negative economic repercussions. I'm not perhaps arguing against that, but saying that at a time under the market reform period in Sri Lanka, when civilian state sector employment had collapsed, which is a traditional and important way in which the rural poor have sought upward mobility and a ladder out of a life of rural drudgery and poverty, at a time when that seemed to have been closed off, the war and military employment perversely compensated for this by propping up this huge avenue of formal sector state employment in the military. So the destruction in the war in the north, in very unexpected ways, promoted the well-being for the poor in the south. The fourth big component of the book is about the ill-fated peace process between 2001 to 2004. And it's really based on a lot of sort of primary research, documents, and personal interviews that I gathered between 2002 to 2012. So it's quite different from the character of the earlier part, which is often based on archival or documentary or numerical data. And I looked at the circumstances of the failure of this very iconic peace process and analyzed the role of the Sinhala Buddhist vote in the April 2004 elections. And in looking at the reasons for the collapse of that peace process, I try to look at the way in which that government promoted a two-track agenda in a very aggressive way. The pursuit of peace negotiations with the LTTE that were fast-tracked, together with a fast-track program of market-based economic reform. And I've argued that the ideological, political, and financial circumstances of the peace agenda in the 1990s, when it emerged, just before that, particularly with the role of the Sri Lankan business community, the idea of business for peace, became very important in the formation of that peace agenda and bringing it to power. But it also meant that it became part of the articulation and the realization of the material interests of a particular segment of Sri Lanka's business community, who by the late 1990s increasingly found the war to be an expensive and futile indulgence. Another very important component of that part of the book, the last part, is a study of the Janata Vimukti Piramana, the JVP, an extraordinary, resilient feature of the Sri Lankan political landscape. And in particular, I started by looking at their role, their very critical role in the collapse of that peace process. But I also ended up spending a lot more time looking more historically at the JVP and looking at its political operation and its formation. So I looked at the evolution of the JVP in the post-1994 period and spoke to quite a lot of the people who had survived the very brutal counterinsurgency that they had suffered in the late 1980s, in the Premadasa period. And I also tried to look at their actions during the peace process. And one of the most fundamental problems in trying to understand the JVP is to look at their hybrid Marxist, Sinhala nationalist persona and the way in which that was both a problem and also an asset for them. Now, in the final chapter of the book, I've also tried to look at the implications of the framework that I've constructed earlier in understanding the Rajapaksa period, which is from 2005 to 14, and the executive presidency that Rajapaksa became one of its most important and iconic representatives of. And I put forward an argument there that Sri Lanka's executive presidency was a project of what I call cosmopolitan capitalism to recalibrate the elite-mass relationship in favor of elites. That is, J.R. Jayawardene, by creating a more stable and centralized and authoritarian political structure, sought to overcome the negative effects of populist electoral democracy. And I say that this project succeeded on its own terms only in the first few years of Jayawardene's own presidency because he had the command of a dependable legislature. But it became undone because of the proportional representation system that came into being by that same constitution, the first elections of which were only held in 1989. And I say it, and I can't possibly summarize it, that the power of the presidency was eventually restored, which had sort of been lost to some extent under the Chandrika Kumarathunga years, under the Mahinda Rajapaksa period in 2005 to 14. But he did it only because the president openly championed the very populist positions that the presidency was purportedly formed to resist.